Till I first met you, I was lonesome. And when you came inside, dear, my heart grew light and this old world seemed new to me.
Welcome to The Sandman Slept Here, part of the Justice Society Presents feed on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, Ryan Daly, along with Paul Kinn and Max Romero. On this show, we review the comic book adventures of the Golden Age hero, Wesley Dodds, known as The Sandman, with a particular focus on the 1990s Vertigo series, Sandman Mystery Theater. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Max? How are you, Ryan?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year at the time this one is coming out. And Happy New Year to all of our listeners.
Yeah, happy holidays to everybody.
So, Ryan, you had some excitement recently, huh?
I did. I was wanted to mention this for the listeners' sake, because if they don't know, I had the delightful opportunity to actually talk to the writer, Matt Wagner, not about Sandman, although if I had more time, I certainly would have asked him some questions about this. But he was he and the artist Kelly Jones are doing have been working on for a couple of years on a Dracula graphic novel series with a couple of different volumes. And it's their take on Dracula that follows the same story, the same continuity, but does some embellishment and kind of explores it from different angles. And I only found out about this recently because of the Kickstarter campaign for their third volume. And when I saw it, I was like, oh, wait, Matt Wagner and Kelly Jones doing Dracula. This must be a project they did in the 90s that they're just now re-releasing or something, right? That seems too obvious. But no, it's a new thing. But they were, anyway, like for the Kickstarter backers, they did a Zoom call Q&A session where they just opened it up to everybody. So I jumped on that, and I was great fortune to talk to both creators. I shout out to Kelly Jones, being at the time that I was getting into comics, he was one of the first artists who I could recognize by name and style, just because he was so distinct with like Batman, Red Rain, and then his run on Detective Comics, post Nightfall, Night's End, Night's Quest, everything when he came on that. So I just knew his style really well. And then with Matt Wagner, I held up my copy of Sandman Mystery Theater Volume 1, the original trade of the Tarantula arc. And I told him what that meant to me. It's just kind of being a very formative comic fan. Again, if I had a little bit more time, but I was already taking a little bit too much, I would have mentioned, I was like, hey, you know, do a podcast about this. Maybe you'd be interested. That'll be for next time. I get it. But one of the things that I asked Matt specifically about, and it kind of dovetails into the material that we're covering on this one, is I was reminded he did an interview on the Word Balloon podcast with John Suntress. And this was more than a decade ago, I'm sure. In it, he was talking about, like, he had been working on Zorro at the time for Dynamite, and obviously he had done, like, Batman and the Monster Man, lots of different miniseries with these characters, and certainly Sandman. And in that interview, he kind of mentioned the fact that so many of these characters, these pop culture characters, like, are really... I don't even remember like how I phrased it back to him or how he said it, but like there is sort of that just their DNA is baked into the time of their creation, the socioeconomic, geopolitical, and temporal era of which they were created. And you can tell Superman stories today, but it's a little bit removed from where he was created and where he belongs. And like the suspension of disbelief is a little bit different. And like the examples he was saying was like Superman can disguise himself with a pair of glasses because not everybody is walking around with a camera in their pocket and not everybody is on television. He's like, you know, like his parents are from that, Matt Wagner's parents were from that generation, and they didn't have photographs of themselves until like the 50s or 60s or something like that. It just wasn't so ubiquitous. And he was talking about Batman a little bit too, and he's like, a billionaire could not do that today. It's not realistic. There would be TMZ following it. But also, it's hard to imagine like an urban vigilante like that in a city where there are no shadows anymore. If you go to big cities, like there's lights and cameras on every corner, and there aren't alleyways and everything like anymore. Like, yeah, he was kind of saying, like, you know, you can take Zorro out of 1800s California and Mexico, but without that specific climate of what was going on historically, Is it the same Zorro? Is it really different? That's one of the reasons why I think he has always kind of gravitated toward period comics and like these kind of like established like pulp heroes like Sandman setting this in the era in which it was created. And he does the same thing with Dracula and with his like wasn't World's Finest, but like his Trinity series, I think it was that he did. So yeah, I just thought it was a lot of fun to talk to him about that.
That's super cool. I'm glad you had that opportunity. That's really neat.
All right, guys. For listeners, we are back to talk about the fourth story arc in Sandman Mystery Theater. This one is called The Vamp, and I'm really excited because our first artist, Guy Davis, is back on the art in this one.
Yep.
But equally, possibly even more importantly, we get the arrival of Matt Wagner's co-writer. Stephen T. Siegel joins the writing chores in this one, and he will stay on the book until the very end of the series after Matt Wagner leaves. So I think, yeah, Siegel actually writes or co-writes more issues than Matt Wagner does. I think Siegel does the last 18 issues by himself, and Wagner only did the first 12 issues by himself. And I talked about this on our first episode too, because when I got into this series, I got it. I wasn't there from the ground up. I bought the last couple of issues, which were only written by Stephen T. Siegel.
You brought the dirt that was on top of the grave, right?
But at that time, I already knew who he was because he was writing Uncanny X-Men. And when I grew up, like in the 90s, I was mostly a Marvel zombie and reading a bunch of those. And X-Men was my gateway into the larger Marvel universe. And for a little while, it was either him and Joe Kelly or him and Joe Casey. I can't remember, but they were writing the two title X-Men books, X-Men and Uncanny X-Men. Siegel was on Uncanny, and they were doing this really cool storyline, and I was enjoying it. And then they were just very abruptly and unceremoniously fired from the books. And Marvel, I think, gave Alan Davis the reins of like co-plotting both books and like drawing one of them or something. And I think that was I was like, all right, I'm done with this. Nothing against Alan Davis, but I was so mad by that that I quit reading those books. So, but yeah, Stephen Siegel, like,
then you found it here.
He had just done a couple of small indie books at like Comico and other stuff before he got the work on this one. So that is a question I would like to either ask him or Matt Wagner about how he came to be the co-writer on this. Was this something that Vertigo was pushing? They're like, hey, we want to give this guy more work because we like him. Or did Wagner need more help on it just because of timing or whatever? So if I do get the chance to ever ask either one of them, I would like to find out more about how Siegel ended up on this book, because this was very early in his career. According to Mike's Amazing World, he had one story in like a Justice League International annual or special or quarterly or something. But then this was his first like mainstream work from either the big two.
It's cool.
And then once this was wrapping up, he moved on to Marvel, where he did Alpha Flight and Uncanny X-Men. And then he and Duncan Rouleau and Joe Casey and Joe Kelly formed the Man of Action Entertainment Company, which did comics as well as cartoons. They were the creators of Ben 10. They worked on one of my favorite comic cartoons, Avengers: Earth's Mightiest Heroes, which is like what Justice League is for the DC Universe cartoon series. I think Avengers: Earth's Mightiest Heroes is that for the Marvel side. I just think it's a phenomenal cartoon, and he was involved in that. So yeah, I've always liked Siegel, and I'm excited that he's joining the group.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know who did what too. Whether it's Matt Wagner plotted and Siegel did the dialogue, or vice versa, or what? Yeah,
because I'm sure we'll probably talk about this when we get into it. Like, I don't notice anything really different about the writing.
I don't either.
In terms of the script, the pacing, and everything, I was I wouldn't have known the difference if I didn't read it in the credits. Yeah,
I didn't notice it until I read the script, and I was like, oh wow, I didn't even realize it. Because I was so excited about Guy Davis coming back that I was like, this is great. I just sloughed right over the credits. So good on you for pointing that out, because it is important.
Well, and it pays off, because Siegel was nominated for an Eisner twice for his work on Sandman Mystery Theater.
Yeah.
And I like it. Like you said, it's a fairly seamless transition. One thing I did notice is that the writing... And we'll get into this. Around the second issue of this arc, I felt like I kind of knew what was happening. I'd already figured it out.
Yeah.
So it wasn't quite as twisty as the other stories were. But at the same time, it felt like it was playing fair, maybe more than the other ones were.
Yeah.
Just because You know, it wasn't some revelation at the end that kind of like shoehorned in there, and it felt a little faster paced. And actually, and one thing I noticed, and we'll talk about this too, is that if I felt like there was more humor, there were more little bits in there.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, little 1930 screwball comedy bits in there.
A little bit, yeah.
I'd agree with that. Yeah.
Before we actually get into our coverage of the story, we do have to pay some bills. This episode is sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. A while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses, so we launched a Patreon and had Shag write the script that we always repeat. And you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. If you are enjoying shows on the Justice Society Presents podcast feed, the best way to support the show is by visiting patreon.com/FWpodcasts.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire and Water Podcast Network. At certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like our all-star squadron of supporters who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents feed. Our thanks to
Alex Osias,
Bill Bear,
Bruno Diaz,
Chris Mort,
Craig Fletcher,
DC Dave,
Devin Clancy,
Ducky,
Extremely Uncanny,
George Van Note,
Jason Keen,
Jay Campbell,
Keith G. Baker,
Kevin Wetter,
Mark Baker Wright,
Matt Ev,
Michael Bailey,
Michael Crouch,
Mike Zomkowski,
Roger Priebe,
Russell Burbage,
Symbol Pending,
Ted Kilvington,
and the outsider Tim Price.
Again, please visit our Patreon at www.patreon.com/FWpodcasts.
And if you want to read along, as we encourage you all to do, and you don't have the original issues, where can you find that? Well, digitally, all these issues are available on the DC Universe app, but you need the Ultra subscription to DC Universe Infinite to read Vertigo books. And then, in addition, there are now two compendiums that have come out collecting the entire series. They're fabulous. I'm reading mine through the compendium. This arc and the next couple are in Volume 1. Volume 2 came out earlier this year. And that is the only place the second half of it has really been reprinted at all.
Volume 2 is on my Christmas list.
Excellent.
I specifically asked that from somebody, so hopefully I'll have Volume 2.
Just so none of the kids go looking through it before they give it to you, Ryan.
Oh, my God. And I will also just shout out, maybe check out your local library. They might have copies of these for you, too.
Absolutely.
Excellent point.
Right. As regards the digital version of this story, available on DC Infinite, Intro, Ultra Infinite, or other online digital services, we have a note about that we will talk about a little bit later in the discussion. But let us get into the story. We're talking about issues 13, 14, 15, and 16, which is a story arc called The Vamp. This whole story arc was written by Matt Wagner and Stephen T. Siegel. The artist, back again, was Guy Davis. Letterer, John Costanza. Colorist, David Hornung. And the editor was Karen Berger. As always, all of the covers are by Gavin Wilson. So, not even sure, the best way to describe these covers.
Max,
you might have a...
Yeah, Max, yeah.
Oh, sure. Throw it to me. Well, they are basically kind of almost like a photo essay. They're a pastiche of different, obviously, posed photos, combined with what look like stock photos from the era,
right?
And put together as a collage. And you know, that for issue 13, the beginning of this storyline, the vamp, we do have a larger image of a woman with a cigarette in a cigarette holder, with a one shoulder dress. I'm sure there's a word for it. I don't know what it is. I'm sorry.
She's giving flapper vibes, flapper or something of that time. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And all the covers kind of have this same vibe to it. You know, they all have the same sort of design, and there's duotone on it. There's some color in it. You could almost say it's kind of busy, but I think the covers actually... I think so far from what we've seen, these are probably the most straightforward covers that we've seen.
In terms of matching the action in the book, I would agree with that 100%, Max. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't find them as compelling as some of the other covers. Now, some of the other covers I didn't like that much. These are more descriptive and a little more literal covers was the word that I had. They do describe what's happening in the book a little bit better than some of the more sort of theoretical ones from The Brute and the other arcs. I agree that they're busy. These were my least favorite of the groups of covers we've covered so far. I don't know about you guys.
I do find them interesting. I like the splash of colors. Like there's heavy like reds, pinks, and purples on these covers that I feel like we haven't had that a lot in these covers. But yeah, instead of having like two or more images sort of like superimposed over each other, the images are all broken up into like inset panels, like circles and everything. And I just, it's interesting and gives it kind of like a magazine or like you said, photo essay type of feel. But it kind of feels off for a comic book where the body of the comic book, the interior pages are broken up into those panels. So you want the cover to be different from that.
Yeah.
Like you want the cover to kind of like really signal out like one splash type of image. Yeah. And this kind of feels like,
well, my podcasting partner, Sean, was mm-hmm. famous for on Batman Family Reunion always saying how he hated box covers from the 70s. Now, these aren't mm-hmm. the same as that,
yeah.
but they are divided up images. And that part of it is very similar. And I can mm-hmm. see his point in these covers.
We get some cool photos, though. We right on the yeah. first one on 13, we get a little photo of the Sandman himself in the bottom circle with his gas gun. On the cover to 14, we see him coming up a set of stairs, but also we get his little doll, his little yeah, Sandman doll thing that Wes has
that's
that
he
keeps
one.
In his bed.
Yeah.
And then like on the cover to 15, he is sneaking through a window or crouching down next to a window, like on a fire escape or something. And then on the last one, we get like an image of like an arm with an intravenous needle pumping out of it, and that'll be coming. And with all of these, there's a lot of female imagery, and that kind of goes to the storyline. There's a lot of femininity vibe to it.
Mm-hmm. And I will say also that it's to younger eyes, it probably looks pretty dated. Mm-hmm. It does have a that very 90s Vertigo look to it, and you know, and these kind of photo mashups, mm-hmm. I think were very common at the time, and it was something Vertigo did a lot of, mm-hmm. and so I'm not sure how that would translate today. If I don't know if it would look old fashioned or not.
Well, it's tough to say. I mean, so many of today's covers are poster covers, right? They're very, mm-hmm. you know, a very small minority of them have, you know, much to do with what's going on in the story, right? And with all the variant covers and everything, it's all so much poster covers, which, you know.
Yeah, that was the other thing. If like an average comic might have 8 to 15 right. covers, and most of them are just a way for the artist to just do a showcase of that character.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right. But,
or some other random cover. It still doesn't. Right. I still don't get when you have yeah. unrelated characters on one. Anyway, but we don't not yeah. here to talk about that. But
sometimes it's just a blank white piece of paper, and it's it like would, it, you yeah. find somebody to draw this.
Yeah, I know. I love that. You're right, Max. I mean, it would definitely be different than what is on the market today. But
which I'm not saying is necessarily a bad thing.
Right. I mean, no, I get you.
Yeah.
Alrighty-o, let's get into it. Sandman Mystery Theater Issue 13, The Vamp, Act 1, has an April 1994 cover date and an on-sale date of February 8th, 1994. A couple's sexual intercourse goes all Basic Instinct. The man, Trevor Barnes, is restrained by people hiding under the bed, and his would-be lover uses an intravenous needle to drain his blood. Diane Belmont goes out with her girlfriends, smokes a joint, and while high, almost kisses her friend Carol. The next day, Diane visits Carol to discuss a United Way fundraiser. She meets Carol's friend, Madeline, and witnesses Carol and Maddie share a passionate kiss. Lieutenant Burke investigates Barnes' murder, questioning his friends at an exclusive social club, as well as the desk man at the apartment where Barnes was murdered. The Sandman investigates the crime scene and finds a clue leading him to the Club Congo. At the club, the woman who led Barnes to his death sets her eyes on another man. Later still, Wesley Dodds takes Diane Belmont to the Club Congo, where they run into Madeline, who openly hits on Wes, despite what appears to be a drop of blood on her cheek.
Issue 14, The Vamp, Act 2, has a May 1994 cover date and an on-sale date of March 15th, 1994. Wes takes an immediate interest in Madeline, but not in the way a suddenly jealous Diane suspects. The rest of their date is spoiled when another victim is found in a hotel room above the club. Wesley can't get rid of Diane fast enough so he can investigate. Of course, she thinks it's because he's now infatuated with Madeline. Wes eavesdrops on Lieutenant Burke's questioning of a bartender who remembers the murder victim earlier that night with a woman known only as the Vamp. The next day, Diane goes shopping with Carol, and they bump into a couple of Carol's sorority sisters, who say they're close friends of Maddie. Diane goes to tell Wesley about it and notices the origami in his office, as well as a strange but somehow familiar doll. Lieutenant Burke catches the Sandman snooping in the medical examiner's office. They fight, but Sandman escapes with a file on the recent killings. Carol sleeps with Madeline. Later, the Vamp picks up a new victim in Central Park.
Issue number 15 had as a June 94 cover date, but was on sale on April 12th of 1994. Diane takes a real interest in the Vamp's crime spree when she learns that all three victims were from the same fraternity. The Sandman eavesdrops on the surviving frat guys at their club and learns that they are targeted because of something called Hell Night that happened in college. Lieutenant Burke stakes out the Congo Club, where he sees Diane question one of Carol's sorority sisters about the murders. Then Burke meets up with the Vamp himself, but when he identifies himself as a cop, she resists. They fight, but she escapes. Diane goes to Wesley to tell him that she suspects Carol's involvement in the murders. They kiss, and Diane is ready to take it further when he abruptly stops them and he ushers her out. She returns moments later to get her purse and finds that Wes has already inexplicably left. The next day, Diane follows Carol to another woman's apartment and gets an eyeful. The Sandman follows one of the frat brothers to a cabin upstate to question him about Hell Night, but he is interrupted by the sudden arrival of the Vamp with a gun.
Issue 16, The Vamp Final Act, has a July 1994 cover date and an on-sale date of May 17th, 1994. The Vamp shoots Sandman in the gut, but he drives her off with his gas gun. He cauterizes the wound with a hot poker from the fireplace, then resumes his questioning of the brother, who explains that Hell Night was a yearly ritual where the frat boys got a sorority girl to entertain them. But one time, it went bad and all of the frat bros raped the girl. And that girl was Madeline. Diane discovers that Carol's erratic behavior is the result of carrying on multiple secret affairs with women. Lieutenant Burke follows a lead to Madeline, who he recognizes as the Vamp, but she escapes again. She goes to Carol so they can flee together, but Carol refuses. Diane goes to Wes, demanding to know why he's so interested in Madeline. He reassures Diane that she is the only woman he's interested in romantically, and things get passionate between them again. Wes can't exactly let Diane see his gunshot wound, though, so he pleasures her until she falls asleep, which is a real superpower. Then he sneaks out. Diane wakes up alone and rushes to see Carol, who has been attacked by Madeline. Madeline meets with one of her sisters slash accomplices, but it's a trap set by Burke. Another sister sneaks up on Burke, though. Then the Sandman sneaks up on all of them. A gunfight ensues, and Burke shoots Madeline dead. The Vamp and her sisters had drained the men of blood to then use to consecrate the land of a property that they owned away from the city, where they could live and love freely away from the touch of men and the negative stigma of their sexuality. Alrighty.
Just another lighthearted story from History Theater.
Compared to the last one?
Yeah. It's a romp in the park.
There's pain, there's bludgeoning, there's violence, but there's also a lot of sex in this story arc, a lot of sex. Mm-hmm. But there's also, we get a lot of good things. We get the return of Guy Davis on art, which we'll talk about. We get the return of Diane narrating. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. We'll see if this trend continues because Wes narrated the first story arc. Diane narrated the second. Wes narrated the third. Now Diane is back for the fourth. So maybe this will continue, sort of an odd numbered, even numbered kind of change up. But Max, sort of big picture, what did you think about this whole story arc?
You know, like I mentioned before, I liked the pace of it. You know, everything was kind of like bam, bam, bam. Everything moved along. Everything was, it's not a slow story at all, even though there are a lot of moving parts. It was, for what we've seen so far, a fairly simple story in terms of the mystery in this case. You know, mm-hmm. it was pretty obvious that it was a group of women who were doing this. I mean, it's revealed in the first panel when, right. You know, people come from behind and under the bed, right. Which is a terrifying scene, by the way. When I saw that, I was, because, you know, this is a lot about vulnerability, mm-hmm. and how that was violated for Madeline when she was in college, which, you know, I went back to the first issue, which mentioned that Diane had been out of college for a little more than a year And I think the sisters had been maybe there a couple of years. So they've only been out of college maybe 2 or 3 years. So it's been fairly recent since this happened. And, you know, it's very interesting in the way that, like I said, I feel like a lot of it is about vulnerability. It's about Madeline's vulnerability and how that was taken advantage of. It's about the men's vulnerability because they think they're untouchable. And also, you know, easily led around by their, you know... little sorority, little fraternity brothers, and and also in a way, it's about how Wes, as the Sandman, is still vulnerable because he in this storyline gets beat up, he gets shot, you know, he goes through it, and I thought that was kind of an interesting theme that I seem to pick up on. And also, I just really liked the characterizations. I liked all of these characters, you know. And Madeline is chilling as a villain.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
The way she targets the men is through sex. She uses sex as her weapon, basically, to lure them into these death traps, in a sense, which is revisiting the pain and the shame and the violation that they inflicted on her a couple years ago, earlier when she was a student. So, in a sense, like the sex is predatory and like murderous in intent, with the exception of the scene between Wes and Diane. But I also couldn't help but notice, like, in that scene, it is not what you might expect a typical sort of conventional sex scene. He performs for her, and it's only one-sided. So I found that kind of interesting, that it plays into the sort of the strength of the sort of the female id of this story arc and how it is, and that Diane is the one who receives it. And, like, so much of this is about lesbian relationships and the way she even witnesses this, from the first time she sees these kisses to looking at the window as Carol and her other girlfriend go at it, and like now and to have to sort of experience that pleasure too for herself. I just found that kind of an interesting choice that is supported by a particular part of the plot, which is actually kind of funny the way it plays out. When you were mentioning it, there's a little bit more humor in it. I thought it was funny that he has to do that for her because he's shot and he can't let her see that he's actually going to balloon if he takes his shirt off. So, right. Anyway, that was good.
No, and also, Diane is the one who pursues him.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Diane's very aggressive.
Twice even. Yeah.
Diane's very aggressive. Yeah, I can't really add any more other than I really liked Diane's character's issues. Frustrated. It's like, why isn't I'm throwing myself at Wes. What's wrong with this dude? And I like that. I like her. She, I think, ups her investigative attempts, you know, to another level. She gets caught at it by Burke. She's poking around Wes's office. She's doing all kinds, you know, she's doing Sandman stuff, walking up the fire escape, looking in the windows, right? That's what Sandman does. He does that
absolutely
all the time.
Absolutely.
And so it's positioning her well to be his partner.
Yeah. I also like that her motivation, her desire to kind of get into this, to pursue this mystery of a sort, even though she's sort of tracking two different mysteries kind of simultaneously, but it's all born out of frustration that she feels everybody is lying to her. She thinks Wes is lying and keeping secrets from her. She thinks Carol is lying and keeping secrets from her. When she actually, like, she's snooping in Burke's office and, like, reading confidential police reports, and he kicks her out. He's like, get out of here. That's confident. And she's like, gets offended by that. It's like, okay, yeah. Diane, you're kind of in the wrong at this point.
Yeah,
she's so annoyed.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, everybody's keeping things from me. It's like, that's a police report. That's not for you.
She's a little entitled in that way, but you know, but that's what makes her interesting. The one last thing I did want to say is one of the beefs I had with the last two story arcs is I had trouble sometimes distinguishing the people and remembering who by visuals, who was acting. None of that here, right? None of that here. This was, it was very clear. You knew who Madeline was. You knew who her two sorority sisters were. You knew who Diane's friend,
Carol,
Carol was. And you knew who all the players were. You knew Burke when he showed up. You could tell who the frat boys were. And that could have gone somewhere towards your description of it. I wouldn't necessarily have used the word simpler, but more straightforward in terms of, you know, storytelling for sure, which I think is a plus.
Getting into more of the details, right, in as we talked about, issue 13 begins with a sex scene. It's this guy coming in with a girl, and they're entering the apartment. She throws him down the bed. She gets naked and they start going. And yeah, page two. Yeah, I mean, it's the best page in the entire book, I think, you know, in terms of art. Yeah. I'm just saying that because of the boobies.
Yeah. I was going to say, okay. that one went right over my head, Ryan. Sorry.
Yeah. But you're right. It goes from this, you know, like a passionate sexual moment to a moment of sheer terror and violence when you're right, when she's got him down and then hands come from out under the bed and grip him. It's like, holy crap. And like, Max, you kind of talked about vulnerability and turning that on its head, because it's so often in these situations and relationships between male and female, especially when sex is involved, the women are more vulnerable naturally. And here, this is part of Maddie's psychology, and her murderous thing is she's flipping that. She's making them feel the fear, them feeling kind of the helplessness because they're tied up, and then drugged. She puts some chloroform to him, but he's not unconscious right away. He's still conscious enough to see them stick the needle in his arm and start to drain his blood. So he dies slowly, and that's gruesome.
And I think they all do, because they're. Mm-hmm. I think the victim after that has similar puncture wounds, but multiple puncture wounds. I mean, just like apparently he was just like stabbed to death.
we'll get to that one the next issue. Mm-hmm. But that one is, I think Maddie did that all by herself. Like she was alone, going rogue on that one, and then she just had to stab him repeatedly to kill him.
But, but I think. You know, that was part of Madeline's psychology. Is she, you know, she wanted these people to pay, and that comes up later. Yeah. That, you know, and she wanted them to suffer in a way similar, but of course, you know, not nearly the same as what she suffered. Right. And that, you know, in retrospect, is still horrifying, mm-hmm. but you can see where that rage comes from. Yeah. And these are definitely, I mean, they're planned, they're methodical. But they are still very much crimes fueled by rage.
Yeah. And then after the first murder, we get our Act One title page. And this was something I was talking to Paul about this before. One of the things that I love when Guy Davis comes back to do these arcs, in addition to the way he draws the characters and he portrays everything, is he has a little an artistic stamp on the title pages of all of these chapters, where the title page is always on a two open facing pages when you get a spread like that, and there is a splash panel that runs across both of the pages on the top of the border that'll give you the title. But then the splash is only over that top panel, because then the rest of the panels on the left page are that page, and then you move into the panels on the right page. There's not like, you can't read it all left to right across both pages. It's just that upper panel. However, that is fine if you're reading a paper, soft or hardcover format version of this book, because you read it. What we have discovered is if you are reading this digitally, whether it is on the DC Universe Ultra Infinite app, or you're reading the old version that I downloaded a decade ago on Comixology and now have to read on the Kindle app or something like that, if it only shows you one page, you are not getting that full splash of the panel that goes across. But sometimes there is important dialogue or text information on the right side of the upper panel splash that you should read before you get to the other panels on the left side page. And that can be lost in the translation if you're reading the digital version of the book sometimes.
So, that's exactly what happened to me.
Well, I didn't realize it because I was reading out of my compendium here. And when I saw that you had made that note in the script, I was like, And sort of right before we recorded, I went and checked on DC Universe. And that's also a problem there. So, you know, it is interesting, you know, that's just when it was digitized, nobody's touched it since then, right?
Right.
However many years ago when all these things were digitized. I don't know when they did this one, but somebody was just doing it mechanically and not reading along.
Depending on when they did it, like you said, Paul, the technology might not even have been there yet.
Right.
You know, maybe. Who knows what they're working from?
Right. Nonetheless, the scene is a great scene, Ryan.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, we get Diane.
Like 4 or 5 pages of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Diane is socializing with her girlfriends. I was like, are these the same girls that she's always hanging out with? But yeah, because they actually mentioned, they're like, are you still dating
Jimmy
from the Face? And she's like, no, we're not seeing each other anymore. We're totally split. But there's another guy that I have in mind. So, but yeah, they're having fun. And then one of their friends is like, hey, do you girls want to do something crazy? And they go, they duck out the back alley of this club where the jazz musicians are smoking reefer, as she keeps referring to it. Mm-hmm. I like the little detail where it's, you know, it's three of the black musicians and then the white guy in the band. And the girls go to the white guy and they're like, we love your music. And the black guy's like, his music?
Exactly. One thing I like about this is the way, for a second there, I was a little worried because I thought, okay, we're taking Diane back to the person she was in the first story arc. You know, kind of flighty and not very deep and just out to have a good time. And you do see that, but that's because she's with her friends. But even then, she's still thinking about Wesley and, you know, and how things are going with him. Diane is a try anything, you know, she's not, you know, she's ready to get down.
She's adventurous.
Yeah, she is. She's very adventurous, which is great because, you know, we see a little bit more about her and why she's willing to get involved in this and start kind of being an amateur detective herself. You know, it makes sense. And it's really cool. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of The Shadow when, you know, how the shadow has agents, you know, through different parts of the city. And I feel almost like that's what Diane is, the other half of the Sandman. We talked about this in other episodes. She is able to reach and talk to people that might not be as accessible to Wesley.
Absolutely.
And, together, you know, that's really going to click, I think.
Absolutely. My favorite line in this one was, I feel so dizzy. This is a lot different from Jimmy's opium pies.
Yes.
That's not her first rodeo.
I know. Diane is, you know, she's smoking weed. She's doing opium. What's going on?
And almost kissing her friend, almost kissing another one. So almost
kissed a friend.
That's nice. And she, their lips kind of brush against each other. And Carol just says, I like you, Diane. She gets up and leaves. And it's kind of funny. When Diane goes back home, you know, her dad, the DA, is always rushing out of the room. He's like, there's not a murder. It's like,
every time she comes home, he's running out.
Something almost kind of vaudevillian about this. It's like every time we have a scene, he's like, there's been a murder. I have to leave. And she's like, wait, before you leave, drop some crucial bit of information that I need for this story. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, you know who the victim was. It was a guy you went to college with. It was around that time, because they do mention later throughout the story that all of the women attended Vassar, which in the 1930s, when this was set, was an all-women's university.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It eventually became co-ed, I don't know when, middle of the century. But yeah, at this time, certainly it was all women's school. Mm-hmm. But they had their, you know, their brother school for the boys that we're talking about from the frat. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and from there we go to the crime scene. We follow DA Belmont to the crime scene, and it is not a pretty one. Because not only has this person been drained of blood with a catheter, his mouth, nose, and urethra have all been sewn shut.
And yeah, that's pretty gruesome. But I do like how Wes is masquerading as the janitor in the DA's office there as Burke is telling him about it. I just thought that was I really like that little tidbit. I love how Wes gets his information. He's like listening at windows. He's masquerading himself. I'm like, that man would be proud.
Yeah, you know? Very much. But yeah, there is a nice little moment with this is a fun story for Lieutenant Burke throughout the story, even though he is constantly getting beaten up or not by Wes, by women, by whoever it is in the story. And like, he's never really successful. It's kind of, you kind of question his competency as an agent in the field, but he's still good because, you know, when they say the medical report said this Trevor Burns guy was having sex when he was murdered, and one of the other cops is like, the captain is like, must a crime of passion or something. And Burke is like, a crime of passion doesn't involve sewing the man's genitalia and mouth shut. It's like, rage and hatred.
Yeah. Like Max was saying. Yeah.
I mean, I would not want to hang out with Lieutenant Burke, but God, he's fun to read.
Yeah.
There's another good moment with him coming up a little bit. But before we get to that, we have a little moment where Diane is leaving. She bumps into Wes. He was just coming to visit her. And they have a little moment when they're walking in the street. And she talks about what they were doing last night and like going out with her friends and they're pounding around. They actually smoked some marijuana there. They experimented with a marijuana cigarette. And Wes is like, oh, yeah, I've had that stuff. And she's like, what, you? She's like, you don't even like alcohol. He's like, oh, no, I've done things that I don't like, but I still, that doesn't mean I haven't done them.
Yeah.
And he kind of like mentions, like, you know, when he was out east. And do you think like this was a situation where Wes's nature just sees, like, I have to try this just to sort of see how it affects me in preparation, maybe being the chemist that he is and the way he's working with these chemicals or something? Or do you think he tried it recreationally, hoping it would cure his insomnia or put an, or like fix his mental and psychological state a little bit?
I think he was searching. I would argue closer to the latter, like you're saying, because I think he was searching for what to do with his life, and the insomnia and stuff was bothering him. And he comes back to New York, and that's when he becomes the Sandman. But yeah, it's a good. I don't get the feeling he was a party guy, right? Ever. I don't think that's part of his makeup. But that doesn't mean he won't experiment, like you said, to try to figure out, you know, what, and things are culturally different. So things that he might have tried there, like the other stuff, you know, he always talks about it. Hey, I've done lots of different things. It's a very different world in the Far East than it is here.
I tend to go the other way. I mean, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, Paul. But I also think that he might have been working on his formula for his gas gun. And trying different drugs, different hallucinogens, that sort of thing. And I don't see Wes testing that on other, you know, just
other people.
Like, testing it on other people. I think he would have tested that on himself. And, you know, maybe in those experiments, you know, he tried these different drugs. He just to see what the effects were and how strong they were and, you know, this and that. But I do think it's an interesting idea also that, you know, he's been tortured by these dreams. And I can see where he would just like, you know, man, can I just have a night of peace?
Yeah. It's a very Batman type of thing, like modern Batman, to be like microdosing like Scarecrow fear toxin just so that he slowly builds up the tolerance for it so that it doesn't affect him. After that,
I think, well, where do you stand on that, Ryan? Where do you?
I agree with both of you.
I don't think we're that far off. I think all these things are probably true. I think, you know, I think we're not that different. You know, I think I think it's, I don't think any of us think Wes is a party animal, is doing
actually
it.
Actually, no, that's my third alternative is he was the pothead. He was the Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. after that, Carol leaves West, or sorry, Diane leaves West to go see Carol. And this is where we see Carol's other girlfriend, Madeline. And you're right, Paul, in that she has, Guy Davis is smart enough with a lot of women all in civilian dress. He gives them signature visual cues. Mm-hmm. And you know Madeline once you've seen her, because she, first of all, she has this very pale skin, but also this kind of like sharp haircut.
Very severe haircut. Yeah.
That's like, it's almost form-fitting like a helmet. Like, it's really close to her, but the way it kind of like sweeps over her ears. And this was something, because later as they describe her as the vamp, her disguise when she's kind of sitting at the bar picking these guys up, the vamp, as we think of like sort of like a provocative woman, a sort of sexualized woman taking that. But vamp is also short for vampire.
Mm-hmm. And how does she,
and how does she kill these men? She drains their blood.
Yep.
Yeah.
We had many brutes before we have any meanings of the word vamp.
Right.
I think they're playing with that kind of, symbolism and wordplay and all that kind of stuff, which is, you know, good writing.
Yeah. But the pale skin, the black hair and the red lipstick, there is a vampire quality to her. Yeah.
Yep. I'm glad you brought that up, Ryan, because I have that in my notes too, that her and her sisters, you know, as we're going to discover, you know, we'll get into it more. But, you know, they are doing this all together. And that did remind me of, like, Dracula's wives and, you know, and that sort of
thing. Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, and especially with the whole idea of consecrating their home with blood. And, you know, that really made me think along those lines also. And getting into how Guy Davis makes everyone so distinct. Everyone has, everyone has a different haircut. But I think also, even if you were just to look at their faces, they all have very distinct faces, which is really kind of cool, because if you look at Davis's art, it can look very scratchy, very kind of raw at first. But there's actually a lot of thought, I think, that goes into his character designs.
Absolutely.
Burke starts questioning Trevor Burns' fraternity brothers at this, you know, upscale exclusive social club in New York. And there's this moment where Burke notices that a waiter is being particularly kind of like staring at him. And he's like, what's that guy's problem? And he's like, oh, you're not used to seeing an Italian in our club. He's like, I'm Sicilian. He's like, whatever you are, sir. And I'm like, interesting. Burke is feeling what it's like to be discriminated against.
Yeah, yeah.
The guy who dropped the N-word in our first story arc is now the blunt of some racism and some discrimination. Ha!
Yeah.
And I like this scene because, like, he is so pissed off and like, contemptuous of these upscale, foppish elite men, but he can't do anything to them.
Yeah.
But as soon as he's away from them, he takes it out on the next guy he sees, which is the manager of the scummy hotel. And he's willing to threaten that guy with violence because he couldn't do it to the guys he really hates, who are the schoolboys.
Yep. Yep.
And I like that, well, I don't like it, but oh my God, when Burke is talking to these former frat brothers and now, you know, upper crust guys at the men's club, they literally just start ignoring him. He's standing right next to them and they just start talking to each other as if he's not even there.
Yeah.
And I was just like, whoa.
Right. Which is a great way that's like framed in the way that Guy Davis captures that in the composition. It's really cool.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it leads so well into that next segment that you're talking about, you know, when he goes in and goes, no, I had just enough of your bullshit attitude for one afternoon. And he, you know, and he just like, is just roughing this guy up. and you know, I mean, I'd be mad too. And I, you know, I can see where, I'm still vacillating on whether or not Burke is a good cop.
he
gets the job done, but I'm sure he bends and breaks a lot of rules to get there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He couldn't do that. Now, what I think is interesting is, you know, he finds out that they're always in the same room. Or this guy is a regular. He brings women to this hotel all the time. And so that's how the vamp would have known to place the two sisters under the bed to restrain the guy. And so that now we understand how that happened in the first part. But Wes actually goes into the room to conduct more of an investigation, and he finds the matchbook that leads him to the Club Congo, which is an important part of that. And Burke doesn't find out about the Congo until a little bit later.
The two pages, too, when we just – they're almost silent pages. Yeah. There's a little bit of dialogue. Great. But, yeah, the same. And he's listening in on from one fire escape and leaps across it to the other one to sneak into the window of the crime scene.
Yep.
And the pages of the Sandman just snooping around. And
I love those.
And everything in those. Like,
I love those.
There's frequently no or little dialogue to them, but I love those pages.
And I was wondering, did Wes leave the matchbook there so that Burke could maybe find it later or not? Or did he take it with him? I don't know. We don't know. That's why he asked Diane to go to the Club Congo for dinner because he wants to check it out, which I thought was brilliant.
Right. And then, yeah, I mean, you guys are right. This is a great sequence. And I have things to say about the coloring later, but the use of shadows, just the darkness of it, you know, is really the sort of thing that makes this comic work so well. I love that panel of him like just stepping on the rail to jump to the next fire escape, which looks so casual. It looks so cool. and he uses it. They use it later. The sound effect of him opening the window, that shook. You know, and if you've ever opened a window with a wooden frame, that's exactly the sound it makes. Mm-hmm. And I just love those little details.
We get this very short scene, although it leads to a more climactic thing later on. But we see the titular vamp. This woman is at a bar right up there, the hotel right next to it. When a man kind of picks her up. And Davis does an interesting thing where he never gives us a good shot of her face, but we do see that she has blonde hair. And the murder, when she murdered the guy in the first scene in the beginning of the book, she had blonde hair. And because of Diane's suspicions of Carol and Carol kind of snooping around, being kind of flighty, I was wondering if they were trying to suggest or trying to, like, if that was like a red herring that they wanted us to think that Carol was the murderer and that she was really the one behind this. But I was like, I never thought that.
Neither. I was gonna say
as soon as we met Madeline,
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's if the
they,
killer.
If they did, right. it wasn't effective. But I don't think so. I mean, you look at her lips and you look at her nose, and the you know it's Madeline from those two. If you're paying attention, if you go back and look at the way she has a very aquiline nose, I think that's the right word, and her bright red lipstick, I think we're intended to know it's Madeline. But, you know, if they were trying to do, like you said, Ryan, I don't think it worked. Because I think you know right away it's Madeline.
Right. One thing I noticed about Madeline also is, and you see this as it goes on, but it's even here in this issue, Madeline can't turn it off. She is always, always flirting with everybody. You know, she's flirting with
except with Diane, who she treats like a bitch, like in their first scene together when they're at Carol's apartment. Like,
instant dislike to Diane.
Yeah.
But even then, she tells her, what does she tell Diane? She tells her, of course I remember you, Diane. How could I forget such a pretty face? You know, kind of what you guys think, her flirtiness is a form of aggression. You know, it's,
interesting.
And like I said, she cannot turn it off. Almost everyone she interacts with, she treats that same way. And I think you used the word predatory earlier, Ryan, and that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, because we definitely get that when Wes and Diane are at the Club Congo, so Wes can snoop around and investigate further the mystery. But Madeline sees Diane and pursues that and goes towards her, where she meets Wes. And yeah, in the scene that ends issue 13 and goes into 14, not subtle at all. And it's a little bit interesting because Wes is clearly like drawn to her and instantly like kind of intrigued by her, probably because his radar is out. And he's like, this woman,
something off with her.
Yep. Yeah, there's something, but he can't explain that to Diane, and also might not even realize. I legitimately don't think he realizes how he's presenting himself and what Diane is thinking of how jealous he's making her.
Yeah, I think he goes for expediency and plays into the jealousy a little bit, maybe when he needs to dump Diane to go as a Sandman. But I think my personal thing is I don't think he's actually attracted to Madeline. I think he's senses something off about her. She's sort of involved somehow, and then he, you know, but I think he pretty quickly puts it all together and is then after the proof or catching her in the act or something like that. Because I think he's pretty adept at reading that kind of stuff.
I mean, the first time he meets her, she has blood on her face.
Right.
It's like a detective is going to, you know, I'm going to put that in my notes for later on.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And she just smears it and then licks it off her finger. It's not subtle.
Not subtle. Right.
But of course, like once she's there, Wes is like, Diane, tell me more about her.
Yeah. I think she's and rather engaging.
Yeah. And she's like, are you freaking kidding me? She's like, you want me to tell you more about the woman who was just flirting with you at our table who came up to us? Really? You want me?
I love how Diane got so jealous so quickly. And, you know, it's indicative of the fact she's really starting to, you know, develop strong feelings for Wes, which is terrific.
Right. And when it's on the right hand of the title page of Vamp Act 2, when after Wes kind of leaves her to find out some information, he comes back to the table, she is sitting with her arms crossed and leaned back and this look on her face. That is an amazing, like very simple lines for Davis to capture that body language and that posture and that expression on her face.
Yeah, it's great. Like that's a great page or a great panel. Yeah, I agree 100%.
Upstairs, a couple floors in the hotel room, we find the next murder victim, and this is why he's like very similar circumstances, but they're like, yeah, he's got 20 or 30 puncture wounds from the needle runner to drain his blood, and obviously wasn't clean because there's blood soaked all over the sheets. So that's why I'm like, okay, this had to be the vamp doing this on her own. She didn't have the backup of the other girls, like her support. I was like, but why? Like, something set her off to do this one alone? I'm not sure about it.
So then we get Wes meeting Lieutenant Burke. And is this the first time Wes has actually met Burke? I know Diane's met him before, but it might be the first time Wes is as Wes, not as the Sandman, right?
think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to say it is.
So, and this is where I think Wes starts to think the connection, because the bottom page of five, Burke says there's been another murder, appears to have been in the company of a lady. And Wes turns and looks and says, and he and Diane have just finished dinner and they're going to go somewhere. Maybe they're going to a movie or a dancing or whatever. And Wes goes, like that. And that's when he dumps Diane into the cab. So I think that's when it's starting to click for Wes. Pretty early on in this story, right? I mean, we're only a couple pages into the second issue.
Right. And I love it. Like after, and he puts her in the cab. He's like, yep, we had a call off our date early. Sorry. And she's like, really, after we just met this other woman who's flirting, you're just going to put me in the taxi again. she's mad. But as she's driving off, we get these three little panels of Wes walking down the alley, pulling his trench coat over, and he's not wearing the mask, but the light is reflecting off his glasses, so they're just white, and it kind of has the same idea of the gas mask, and it's a really cool like little visual element. Mm-hmm.
So he's taking a risk here because he starts listening in on the conversation with his listening device, but he's not dressed as a Sandman, so he can't get caught. Yeah. And some guy comes up and chases him off, which I thought that was interesting, that he's doing the Sandman thing, not being the Sandman. I thought that was pretty neat.
I'm not sure how far into his career as a Sandman he is at this point. I mean, I think it's still fairly early, right?
Right.
Because he keeps getting caught.
Yeah.
And he manages to get away, but he does keep getting busted listening in, breaking into offices, you know, that sort of thing. And I really like that. I really like that he's not some infallible, you know, hero who, you know, is always two steps ahead of everybody else.
Right. Well, he's a Sandman. He's not Batman.
Right.
The next day, Diane is shopping with Carol, and they come across two of their other college sorority sisters. We see Betty and Sally. Sally, who also has a very distinctive hairstyle and look about her too. But Sally is the owner or the manager of the Club Congo. So there's that connection, okay, in terms of just proximity and connection to these events and the woman at the bar. She's kind of always there. So,
and that's when Diane says, let's all go have lunch. So there's Diane doing a little digging. They're like, oh, let's go to the Congo for a drink. And Diane's like, well, let's have lunch. And then they all go have lunch instead, which I find interesting.
Yeah, and I think there's a little bit more of that misdirection. Because if you notice, they all have those red lips that we were talking about with Madeline. And there's on page 11, the fourth panel, where we see Sally.
Yep.
And she kind of has those red lips. You know, and it's, you know, I think, like you, like we were talking about, I think they're trying to misdirect us a little bit, but it's pretty obvious who the real killer is.
Yeah. Maybe.
And Diane cannot wait to go see Wes, not just because he's her boyfriend, but because she has to tell him like what's going on, all these new theories, and like just kind of like gloat about the investigation that she's doing. But while she's in his study, she notices these little origami figurines on his bookshelf. Put a pin in that, listeners, because that is foreshadowing for an event in the next story arc. But she also notices the doll on his bookshelf. And as soon as she picks it up, she's like, what is this? And he's like, oh,
that shouldn't be out here. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's like, there's something familiar about this. But because it's funny, like it's not a doll with a gas mask. So it doesn't look like the Sandman unless you're already associating it with the Sandman. If you think about it, then it's like, oh yeah, it's a little Sandman, almost like a voodoo doll or something, but like represent it. But it's like, no, it doesn't have the mask or anything. It just has the solid blank white eyes and like the hat and everything in the suit. But it's like, it could be anything. But if
I love
the Sandman is in your mind already, then you make that connection.
Yeah, this is my favorite scene of this issue, this two pages, because Diane's there. Diane does actually give him a clue, because he says Sally manages the Club Congo. So now we realize, oh, okay, the Club Congo is where, you know, Maddie's picking up these guys, right? They all go there. They go to the seedy hotel next door to have sex, and they have all these things. So this is now clicking for Wes, and that's when he goes to see Burke at Burke's office and get the medical examiner's report, which is a funny scene too.
But like as he's walking her out of that, like when Diane leaves, Wes is clutching the doll.
Oh yeah, like, that's with great.
Both arms across his chest, like he's very protective of it. But it's also like there's something
Yeah, that's a great panel. Yeah.
And that hasn't been explained yet, right? No. The significance of the doll, other than, you know, it's obviously supposed to be a Sandman, but.
Yeah. Well, that word again, that last, on page 14, that last panel of just him, we don't even see his whole face. We just kind of see his little almost childlike, lip quivering around as he's holding this doll. It's just, Max, you mentioned the word vulnerable before. Mm. It's like, it's, and we don't understand why or where this is coming from, other than, I mean, it could be his secret. It was almost exposed if Diane made that connection, but also wherever this thing is coming from inside of him, this is the most vulnerable we have seen Wes look, at least emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, that's a good point, because he's not just holding, he's clutching it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's holding it to his chest with both arms, you know, and I just want to point out one of the, it was not like haha funny, but I thought it was funny. When Diane is looking at the doll and he's telling her to be careful, it's a piece of Amish folk art. I don't know what kind of Amish people he's been hanging out with, but they don't usually do, like, you know, blazers with ties and fedoras, as far as I know.
That sounds like a Mad Libs, like, word jumble thing. It's like three things that don't belong to the Amish folk art. Okay. But then, yeah, Paul, you're right. Like, we get go back to Lieutenant Burke, and he's talking to the crime forensic examiner, and they walk into the office and they turn on the lights, and there's the same, caught again. And again, it's like, at this point, it's like, how many times are Burke and Sandman going to do this thing?
That is a great panel right there on page 15, 1, 2, 3, 4, where he just turns around. Like, you can just see it flip. The light goes on, and there's Sandman turned his head looking at him. What a great, like, and Burke is like, what the hell?
What the hell?
and I didn't remember until I was rereading this, but I was like, if the Sandman gasses him again, so like, at some point that's going to have real severe effects on Burke. But like, so I love it that they do have this really cool fight, and Sandman tries to shoot him with gas, but he misses. Burke starts a fire in the garbage can to cause this other distraction, opens fire on what he thinks is Sandman, but it's actually just Wes put his hat and his trench coat on a coat hanger to kind of disguise.
Clever. I thought that was clever. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then jumps him from behind, but doesn't have the gun. So he just kind of like restrains Burke until he can basically gets the leverage to throw him across the room. And then he grabs the file and he sneaks out of there, and Burke has to like kind of climb out of there and then grab like the fire extinguisher from the hallway. But it's like, okay, he wasn't gassed this time. He did almost die of smoke inhalation.
Yeah, and he can't chase Wes because he's got to put the fire out that Wes started in the trash can, which is pretty neat.
Well, like, at this point, it's like, okay, this is kind of becoming a funny little dance that they do every
running gag, I really like that sequence on page 18 because it shows Wes's physicality in a different way than we've seen, because mostly what we've seen is him kind of punching people and that sort of thing. Here he's using, you know, I don't know if it's a wrestling hold or a martial arts hold, but he kind of, you know, grabs him from behind, just kind of throws him to the ground. And I like that, you know, because that kind of that's a hint of the training that he's gotten while he's been, you know, out of the country, and, you know, probably what he's been trying to learn for himself. And like a sequence in the previous issue, this is almost wordless. I mean, there is some dialogue, but not a whole lot. And I think that works really well. It's and like I said, I mean, I would not want to have a drink with Burke, but, you know, he is so much fun, at least in this run.
After a moment, we get a brief little scene between Carol and Mano. And you're right, like, Paul, in terms of Max, how quickly this story kind of moves. There's a lot going on. There are a lot of like one page scenes and little bits between the different characters, but they're brief, so it keeps moving along. We get a lot of forward momentum and progression in the story. But then, we see Diane goes to her dad's office. He's not there, but she finds the crime report, the report on the victims and everything. And she's like, oh, this is interesting. She starts reading it, and Burke walks in. He's like, why is everybody like
looking at my stuff?
And he's like, everybody's trespassing in the building and taking all these confidential files and everything. So I think he overreacts in part of that. He lashes out and yells at her because he just had to deal with this with the Sandman the night before. Right. And then she just feels like gets defensive because he's so harsh in his reaction to her. So I think she throws back. She's like, hey, hey, hey. And that's part of her feeling indignant about it.
But. Yeah.
Right.
But then you see we've got Maddie has shown up at Carol's. It's more sex going on. But then Maddie leaves. But before she does, she says, hey, you got to come to a sorority meeting tomorrow at my apartment. The others are going to be there. We're going to have important things to discuss. So that's a little bit of a preview of what's happening in the next issue. But then she goes off and to get another victim, another one of the men. And that's how we end the issue, issue two.
Yeah. The little carriage ride, the handsome cab in Central Park where a guy's been picked up by the vamp. She takes him into the park, sits him down on the bench where she starts unzipping his pants and going down. He's like, you're going to do this on the bench, right? How? And then this is kind of the same type of thing. He is in bliss, and then the hands just reach out from the darkness behind him and pull him back. And as the end of that issue, again, sort of from ecstatic to horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think it's interesting and not wrong how easy it is for the vamp to seduce these men. These are high society men, but they're not very smart.
No. Right. No.
We get Carol actually attends this little meeting of their sorority sisters, and we see Betty and Sally and another one there. But on page 3, the images of Madeline, we see her in two panels, and it's very like almost washed out. Like there's like a cross hatching effect over her face that like at first, is she wearing a veil or something?
No, I thought it was to make her look, because she's in the shadow. She's not in direct sunlight. I thought it was to give her some sort of vampire effect, you know?
Okay, like, maybe.
That's what I interpreted it as, but I agree with you. It's very, you know, she's been so like sharp and smooth and clean, you know, and how she's been depicted around her haircut and her eyes and her lips. And she's very demonic looking almost in those pictures.
It's very ghoulish, and it's not just shadows, it's cross hatching, which almost looks like what you would see in a movie of someone who is angry at someone, you know, and crossing out their eyes and their face, and you know, it looks very severe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And like you said, you know, her face is very pale, and in that last panel on page 3, there's a lot of that cross hatching, but you can still see her teeth, which gives it like this feralness almost. Yep. You know, if you didn't know it already, this really tells you that Madeline is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Burke questions the rich kids again, who again, like he's trying to get information on there, and they're like, aren't you supposed to be protecting us? Do your job. It's like, yeah, jackass. Give him the information he needs, and he can do that.
Burke came prepared not to put up with anything this time around.
Right.
Yeah. But this is what we learned about Hell Knight. Yeah.
Right. Once Burke leaves and the guys are all alone, or so they think, they start talking. It's like, hey, do you think all of our friends are being killed off because of that horrible crime we committed a long time ago? And of course, the Sandman is outside the window listening in the rain, which is a really cool. I like that image of him just like
that's a great
almost all blacked out in the shadows of the rain. But,
yeah, that's a great one. I love how he's got this knack of finding the windows where people are talking about secret stuff. You know, I just love that knack that Wesley has. I think it's great.
And Diane again gets frustrated that everybody's keeping secrets from her, so she goes to Sally, her sorority sister, who runs the Congo Club, or the Club Congo. And she's like, I'm just helping out my father, the district attorney, and just had a few questions about this case. It's like, okay, Diane, this is taking it up another level. It's like, this is really close to impersonating a cop or impersonating an officer to get this information under these pretenses. So, all right, Diane, let's see what are you doing here.
And Sally has the reaction I think most people would have, and she goes, "I think it's very sweet that you're trying to play detective."
Yeah,
but really.
Yeah. But I love the next scene where, as Diane's leaving, we cut, and as she's leaving, she walks past, doesn't notice that he's there, walks past Detective Burke, who's hanging out in the bar, looking around because he has heard that the vamp hangs out there from the guy he beat up. And the bartender's like, hey, psst, hey, that's her over there. And so he goes after her to proposition her.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a question I have for you guys. What happens, of course, is, you know, they go outside, they start to proposition, and he tells her he's a cop, and she beats him up and leaves. But why, if her mission is to go after these guys that committed this atrocity against her from the fraternity, right? Why is she wasting her time with a random guy in the bar, right? Because that's just added risk for no return, unless she hates all men, which probably is true, but that's not the stated reason for her actions. So
I had the same question.
I was like,
he is, if she's targeting specific people, specific men,
right?
He should not be a target.
Right.
Why would she leave with him? Why would she go into the alley with him? Like, this, as like, was this just going to be sex and not murder? Like, I don't think that's her.
Yeah, I don't agree.
It might just be kind of a goof in the story, that just like they needed a moment like this or something. And it's
but this is where, when during the fight with Burke, her wig falls off. And this is where we now know that the blonde vamp is not really blonde.
Right.
So that is another important clue for us as the readers, even if we haven't figured it out. Right.
Right.
And once he identifies himself, she's like, "You bastard." And she lashes out at him, scratches his face. He punches her. Knocks her to the ground, and then she kicks him in the balls, and that's when she's able to escape.
Right.
Yep.
You know, I just want to address the question that you guys were asking too. I don't know, but the we're kind of assuming that she kills every man that she is with, and I don't know if that's necessarily true. Like I said, she can't seem to turn off that aspect of her sexuality. And I don't know if she, quite possibly, I mean, she's crazy. You know, she is at the very least harming men, but I don't know if she was planning to kill Burke or have sex with him or what she was planning to do with him. I think that's an interesting question because otherwise it makes no sense why she would just be picking up random guys. But the bartender, I don't know if it's in this, I think it was in the previous issue, mentions that she just picks up guys regularly at the, at that bar. And I don't know if she's
true. Practicing. She wouldn't be killing all of them.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's a little plot hole. I think it's a little plot hole.
Mm-hmm.
Meg, I see what you, that definitely, from a little bit of information that we've gotten, that does seem like it tracks with her character. But of the whole plot of them, like, draining the guy's blood to use to consecrate this land has a very witchcraft feel. And she is in this, the one non-murderous relationship she seems to have, at least until the very end, is with Carol, with this other woman. Part of me has a hard time believing she would engage in any kind of relations with a man.
Yeah, I agree.
Without that isn't intended to kill him.
Right.
From what the bartender said in this moment suggests otherwise. So I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't. I mean, like I said, I think at the very least she's hurting people. Mm-hmm. Maybe not killing them all, but she's, you know, I don't know. But then again, you would think that, you know, one of these guys would come back to the bar and say something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. And you guys are probably right. This is probably just a way for us to see the wig come off.
Yeah. And give Burke something to do. I think that her mission, all these women are smart. So they have a plan. Right. And I don't think they're doing things by accident. I don't think Madeline does things based on her libido. I think she's doing things based on her rage, like you were talking about. And therefore, it's, I believe, inconsistent of her to do this with, you know, to be taking Burke out unless she, you know, plans to do him harm. And so, but why? That's not consistent with the rest of her plan. So I think it's a little plot hole personally.
Right, right.
Then we have a great scene where, once again, Diane's showing up at Wes's house. And she throws herself at him, which is great.
And he has to be like, I'm sorry, Diane, I have a meeting tomorrow. And she's like, what?
What? And then she forgets her purse and she goes back in, and Wes is already gone because she's given him the clue. So that Wes is like, I got to go talk to Carol as the Sandman. So he gets a clue and boom, out, he's out of there.
Yeah. And he just like pushes her on. She's like, are you kidding? And then she gets her car. She's like, I forgot my purse. So we see that he has already kind of ducked out of the bedroom, leaving his little doll on the bed. And when she goes back, she's knocking, pounding on the door, and she wakes up the butler, Humphreys, and he's like, I'm sorry. She's like, Wes couldn't hear me knocking and pounding on. He's like, oh, Mr. Dodds isn't here. He didn't come back. He's like, I was just here a moment ago.
I love it.
And they actually like go inside, and like she looks around. He's like, he's not here. Where the hell did he go?
Yeah. Her face, bottom right panel 16. I love that expression. That might be my favorite panel in the whole story. She's just like, grrr, that Wes. I love that panel.
So then she turns into Lady Sandman again, or Sandwoman.
Yeah, Sandwoman.
Because she starts following Carol. She's like getting into the cab to follow her. She's snooping around the staircase. She's climbing up the fire escape, breaking her heel.
Shocked that she's not a natural blonde.
And gets to the window, and just the three panels. She's like, oh, wow.
And this is the woman that Carol really does love, right? And she's magnetically attracted to Madeline, who has her in her orbit. But this is her real. We don't find out till the next issue when Diane speaks to her.
Right.
I think it's the next issue. Yeah, it's a couple pages later. But this is, you know, she's like, this isn't Carol's neighborhood. Like, what's she doing here? And that's when she sneaks up, gets her eyeful, as you put it. And we later find out that, of course, this is Carol's lover. And it's sad because she's like, oh, we can never really be together. And that's the commentary on the situation in the 1930s.
Right. She can't. She kind of has a kind of practicality about her that she doesn't expect Carol to be monogamous, because it's like, we're not going to get married. We can't.
Right.
Not in this country anyway. So she's like, Carol doesn't know what she wants. But so she's always going to kind of go around and look for other people. So, a kind of sad resignation from this woman. But
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I went ahead a little bit there. Sorry, Lenny.
Well, the issue ends when we get the one of the frat guys who was at the social club talked about this Hell Night thing, whatever this event was that may have precipitated these murders. He has gone out to a cabin to kind of stay safe from the threat. I just don't have sex with people, and you don't have to leave the city.
But I think, talk about not being smart, Max. Well, if this is where Hell Night happened, and you think
I'm going to return to the scene of the crime,
you're going to return to the scene of the crime. Guess what? She knows where the place is too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And these guys, you know, they had mentioned it before. Oh, if you need to get out of town, go to the cabin, which apparently, you know, this is the frat cabin. Obviously they know about it. Probably everyone in that frat knows about it. And obviously their victim knows about it.
Right.
And not the shortest.
We'll come back to it in a second. But he's putting logs on the fire when the Sandman sneaks up on him and confronts him, and the guy's kind of trying to get rid of him, but he grabs one of the tools from the fireplace and everything, and hits Sandman across the face, but he gasses him, and before he can start to interrogate him. The gas, this is an interesting little effect, the gas is blown away because of a sudden wind in the room, because the door has opened behind him. And that's when we see the vamp standing there with a gun. She's like, wow, I don't know who you are, but it appears half of my job's already been done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great cliffhanger, because all you see is the gun going off. And, she can't have missed Sandman at point blank range.
Right.
Right.
And she doesn't, because
he hasn't.
The next issue starts, he's like, shot! And just drops. And then she starts to take out her toolkit to drain this guy's blood. When Sandman kind of wakes up, he recuperates enough just to kind of like fire his gas gun. Doesn't really get her, but she coughs enough to kind of run away to protect herself. And he has to take his mask off just because he's now like like dangerously close to going into shock or bleeding out. You see, he's like, he has to stop the bleeding. So he sees the red hot poker in the fireplace. And he's like, you can do this. He just like, before he even has it, he's like, oh, shit. He's like,
this is going to happen. He's like, this is going to hurt. Like, this is going to hurt.
Shit. He's like holding, pressing it to his skin to cauterize the bullet wound. And then he just like collapses like in a fetal position. He's like, oh, God, that was bad. Yeah. It was a nice, again, a moment of physical vulnerability from the hero that is
very visceral, very visceral, which is, I think, part of the appeal of the whole series is it's very, you can feel what all these characters are feeling, which I think is clever. And then we get the scene that I mentioned of Diane with Carol's lover, who does she have actually get a name?
I don't
know if she ever introduces herself. I don't know if she ever names herself.
Yeah. And she says, you know, and she convinces Diane, though, important is that Carol's a good person. She's just a little lost. You know, she's taken with some of these things. We can never truly be together. And Diane leaves convinced of that, but sad on their behalf, which is the message, right? And that's an important part of the storyline.
And again, we see how open-minded Diane is. First, she's dating Jimmy, who is an Asian man, and she's not shocked by drug use, obviously. And I think she is surprised by the same sex relationships that her friend has, but she's not
judgmental.
She's not judgmental about it at all. And there's a panel there on page 5 that says, how sad, how utterly sad to have to live one's life awash in secrecy. And that is,
she's very sensitive. She's very empathetic. Yeah. She's good-hearted. She's progressive in a lot of these sense. She's sensitive to, like, the racial slurs and casual racism that she hears from her friends in that group, like earlier in like the first issue when they were at that party. She's not concerned or hung up or afraid of hanging out in like the Harlem or the areas of town and everything.
She has a strong sense of what is just.
So Wes, he's able to recover enough of himself. He starts interrogating this guy again. He doesn't put his mask back on, but the guy is so we kind of get his POV, and it's like the artist from the Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Ralph Steadman or something like that. It's just like this crazy little.
I mean, Wes was counting on that. I thought that was a little risky on his part, but I guess he can tell. Maybe he knows from experimentation, like you were talking about, Max, that this guy's not going to really remember this conversation. So let me. Don't have to put my mask back on.
The top half of that page, I was like, your mask. it's pretty obvious that this guy is not going to recognize Wes even if he sees him later.
That's kind of this sort of thing reminds me of the Justice League cartoon when Wally West the Flash switches minds and bodies with Lex Luthor. And Luthor's like, well, at least I can unmask and find out who the Flash is. And he takes his mask off and looks at himself in the mirror. And I have no idea who the hell this is. He's like, who is this guy? I don't know. This doesn't give me any information.
Yeah. Like, but this scene is important because now we find out what Hell Knight happened. Right. We get the story. And then at the end, the shoe drops that, who was this sorority girl? It was Madeline Giles.
But if the guys knew who she was, and if they suspect whoever's killing our brothers seems to be targeting the guys who maybe it was connected to that woman that we raped, because they're all being killed while they're having sex, all right, I can see why they wouldn't tell that to Burke, because hard to explain. It's like, well, why would she be targeting us? Because we committed this horrible crime. I would expect them to do more to protect themselves or to actually go after her. Like at least one of them would like know, okay, if Madeline is the one picking us off, let's just get rid of her.
No, you could totally understand them not telling Burke about it, you could have seen them saying, all right, we gotta find this girl and do something about it permanently so that she doesn't squeal on us and all the rest. And these are the kind of guys who, if you really thought about it, would have like not even known the name of the girl. And so that would have been more consistent So I guess this is the only purpose of this is for Wes to get confirmation of who the vamp is. Mm-hmm. So it's a story, a little bit of a story crutch. But I think it's a you're absolutely right, Ryan. I actually didn't catch that, and now that you said it, I think it's a bigger plot hole than the first one. So then Diane is coming home, and the phone is ringing, and it's Wes, and she's first delighted to hear from Wes. But what does Wes do? Wes asks her where Madeline is, and Diane just gets pissed off all over again, which is fabulous. Another great sequence of panels with Diane's face, and she says, "Go. I don't know where she lives, but you know, maybe go look at Carol's. Maybe she's there. And if Madeline's not there, maybe you can bird dog another one of my friends. Goodbye." Click. I just love it. That's great. And then, of course, Sandman does go to Carol's,
right? Who is obviously expecting Madeline,
right?
Because she's asleep, and she turns and goes, "I was starting to think you weren't going to come, Madeline." And then she realizes, mm-hmm. "Oh, that's not Madeline,"
right?
There's another little bit of comedy, but that I really like because it shows again how Sandman is just a guy running around in a gas mask. And on the last panel of page 9, he's leaving. And he said, you know, it's the whole Sandman voice. It's "Sleep well, Carol Swanson. I will see you in your oh, damn," you know, because he's the pain from that wound.
Mm-hmm. Burke talks to the red guy and gets the lead, and he actually knows where to find the woman who he hasn't identified yet. But he goes to, this is Madeline's actual apartment. The name that she's registered under with the electric company is Carmilla Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another vampire.
Yes, there was a short story connection by Sheridan Le Fanu called Carmilla. It was about a female vampire with this lesbian undertones. Or
wow.
One of the earliest vampire stories.
So then Burke goes to her apartment. You know, she beats him up or she escapes. And
she stabs him in the arm with the knee.
And now she's on the run, so she needs to collect her sisters, but Burke sees the sorority sisters' pictures of them, Sally Starr, the manager of the Congo, and Burke has now put it all together.
Yeah, Burke, like, separate from Wesley Dodds and the Sandman in his investigation, Burke is doing the detective work. He's putting the pieces together. He might be a step behind Wes,
right?
But he's still doing it, and it's shown that he is a good cop. But like, this is twice that this woman has overpowered him and gotten away from him.
Yep.
And the Sandman does it on the regular. It's like,
yeah.
Burke, I don't know, hit the gym or do something. You got or just don't go anywhere alone. Like have backup all the time.
You would think that Burke would have a partner, but you know, then again, who's going to partner with Burke?
Wes is in his room. He has bandaged up his side and everything. He's got it. And Diane kind of storms in, and he has to quickly like wrap up his bathrobe to kind of cover it. And Humphreys tries to explain. He's like, "No, it's fine." And she's like, "You better start explaining to me." And he's like, "Look, I'm not interested in this woman, Madeline. It's like, not in that way." And he tells her, like, "This is a little embarrassing, but I fancy myself an amateur detective. And it's just kind of as a thought exercise, I was trying to solve this mystery."
Pretty weak excuse there, Wes.
Well, he couldn't say I have gastrointestinal distress for the eighth time.
Even though you would think Diane would be a little more sympathetic, since she just said the same thing to someone else in the last issue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. She throws herself out, and they literally go down on the bed together. We cut away briefly to see Madeline goes to Carol and kind of stops, and as she's now a fugitive on the run, and she's like, "We have to go." And Carol's like, "No, I'm not going with you. Like, I've had enough of this. I can't. I don't love you, and I don't want to be part of this world anymore." But she's like, "But don't worry. I promise I won't tell the cops." And right. Madeline's like, "No, you won't.
No, you won't.
I'll make sure of that." And then we cut back to Wesley and Diane in the heat of passion, and she's like reaching down and runs her hand over his wound. She doesn't realize it, but we just see him biting his lip, like, and he's like, "All right, gotta change tactics here." He goes down, and we just see the expressions on her mouth, the close up of the three panels of her in ecstasy, and she falls asleep.
Good work.
Bravo, Wes.
Yeah, good work.
Let's see Alan Scott do that.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I was going to make a wood joke, but I'll refrain.
His weakness. And as Wesley's sleeping out, we see she's kind of curled up. He put the blankets over her just so that she could sleep. And she kind of got her arm around the doll a little bit. But also, as he's leaving, he goes, pleasant dream. Sleep well. Can't say pleasant dreams. There's too much negative association with that. And then he finds Madeline, and she has been tied up, and she has been drained of blood, although she's still alive, and beaten severely and tortured by Madeline. But he's able to kind of like cover her up and keep her alive for a minute. This, the timing of this, like, I think we're getting like some weird intercuts because Diane wakes up, Wes is gone, she rushes out of there, and then she's immediately at Carol's apartment, where Sandman is still there, standing over her. And she doesn't freak out, she's not afraid, and she doesn't think the Sandman is doing this, or has hurt her.
Right.
She's really open to his explanation. And it's like, you need to stay with her, there's an ambulance on the way, but make sure she doesn't go into shock or die before they get here.
I think that page 19 happens in real time before 18, but it's cut this way for a dramatic effect.
Right.
You know, it's not confusing, but you're right. I mean, the apartment, you know, she has to have left while Sandman was still en route, right? For her to arrive so soon after Sandman has discovered Carol.
Right.
And she might not have been taking a 3-hour nap. He might have told for like 10 minutes.
Right, exactly.
Wes is good, but I don't know if he's that good. I appreciate the sequence with Carol, who's obviously in bad shape, because when he first gets there, she doesn't even realize that it's the Sandman. She thinks it's still Madeline.
Yeah.
Saying, I'll meet Sally at the Congo with you. You know, I'm sorry, just don't hurt me anymore. You know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But on the last panel on page 18, Wes has it's a close-up of Sandman, of his gas mask, and he says, rest free from worry, Carol Swanson. I won't leave you alone in the darkness. That's an aspect of Wes that we don't see very often in his Sandman persona. We haven't had a chance to see that yet. And I like seeing him as a defender as well as this avenging force.
It's confirmed by Carol at the back of the next page when after Diane has gotten there and Sam is like, I've got to go. And she's like, wait, you can't just leave us here. And Carol's like, no, Diane, let him go. He's going to stop her. It's like, he's the hero. He's the one we need. And there's just kind of like this, I almost kind of hear the music, the trumpet's call for this scene. It's like,
And he also tells Diane that I have faith in you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a huge step in, not so much in the relationship between Wes and Diane, but between Wes as Sandman and Diane.
I love the panel at the top of 21. When we cut away to this is where they've all been heading. It's the alley by the Congo Club, and Sally Starr is standing there in front of the car with the headlights on, so she is backlit. Not in total silhouette, but enough of it. And I like the way that looks. And Madeline walks up, she's like, why are you just standing there like an idiot? And Sally's like, take a guess. And she holds up her hands, and she's in handcuffs. And Burke was waiting for them.
Yep, Burke has, you know, arrested Sally and been waiting. They've been waiting for Maddie to show up. But then the other girl, Debbie, also has a gun.
I've been calling her Betty, but Debbie, yeah.
Debbie also has a gun and threatens Burke.
Third time, you can't try to arrest this woman and somebody got the drop of you.
Yeah. Maybe it's Burke. Maybe he's okay at the detecting, but not so good at the physical aspects of being a cop.
And when Sandman saves him by gassing Debbie and the gas sprays to Burke too, he's like, shit, not again.
Yeah, he hates the Sandman's gas. I love it.
This is what, the third time he's been gassed?
I think? It's just great.
At least. Has it happened? I would say maybe fifth, but who knows?
Yeah. Yep.
Madeline's open fire. He kind of sneaks up on her, but before he can gas her and put her down, like, Burke stands up in front of him and just shoots her.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, she has a gun and she was probably.
Oh, no. It's a righteous shooting. She's open fire on her. She's trying to kill. Yeah.
Yeah. It is a shootout, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's where we get, this is the page where we also get, that insight into what's kind of what's been going on. Sally is there. She says, Madeline, and Madeline is crouched on the ground, you know, clutching the gunshot wound. And she says, they deserved it. Every last one, take it, take the blood, consecrate our home, you know? And that's where you're kind of going like, wow, this is, you know, this is probably even more twisted than we realized. Because I know reading this, I was not expecting that little detail.
But overall, I mean, the things that this story arc did, it gave us more insight into Diane by allowing her to narrate. We see her taking even more action, spurned a little bit by her frustrations, certainly by feeling like she's being kept out of the loop, being kept in the dark, and she needs answers, damn it. And she's going to get them herself. So she's doing more detective work. She's almost impersonating Kopp. She's saying that she's working on behalf of her father, who's a district attorney, to kind of get some of these answers on her own little investigations. She's sneaking around windowsills and fire escapes and everything.
Yeah.
But we also get an advancement in the Wes and Diane relationship. They actually have a sexual engagement in this. We've seen the Sandman now shot and shown his human side and having to deal with a bullet wound. So yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff in the story. Definitely an easier read and a more enjoyable read than The Brute.
Yes, 100% agree. 100% agree.
Like that this is still pretty dark, and especially in terms of the crime, the original crime of the
which we don't spend a lot of time on that, and I guess I'm glad about that, but I also like it surprised me we don't get more of an in-depth look in that to kind of build our, well, we don't really, we never really gain sympathy from.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think they were going for sympathy for her. Yeah, we don't go
for sympathy for Madeline. And maybe if they really harked on that moment, they would have gone for that effect. But I guess we don't. Maybe Matt Wagner was like, you know, we got enough of that in the last issue. or the last story arc in the Brute. Yeah, we're like, we don't need to go for any further than this, but.
It's definitely dark, but it's not as dark.
Right. In the Tarantula, we had this incestuous relationship. In the Face, we had this racism, xenophobia. In the Brute, we just had child abuse. Yeah. And now we've got an element of
sexual abuse,
homophobia, just sort of societal, cultural homophobia that leads to this tragic relationships been doomed between these women, but also a revenge story based on rape. So it's a gang rape, even if you say a whole fraternity. Because he's like, how many men were behind this? The guy's like, I don't know, all of us, 20 or 30. It's like, Jesus, was she gonna kill 20 or 30 of these guys?
Yeah.
But also, Jesus, would 20 or 30 guys did that?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I like this story. I like it more than The Face. I mean, we talked about this a lot in the last one. Like, The Brute was a hard story to read and to sit through, but I think it was really well told in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think The Tarantula was my favorite story just because of it. It didn't make me want to cry, but it was still a fun mystery. I still think Tarantula is my favorite story of these first four, but. This one was, I like this one a lot.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think Tarantula is probably my favorite. And that might be just because, like I said before, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Chinatown. I like The Brute in terms of how it is written, but it's certainly not my favorite story.
Yeah.
And not something I would revisit, and certainly not something I would foist on someone and say, no, here, you should read this noir story. But I like this one. Like I said, I like the pace. I like the characters. It moved along at a pretty good clip, and there was a lot of character work in it. And I like that. And as you were saying, you know, it's a big step forward in Wesley and Diane's relationship.
I agree with all that. Before the two little plot holes we found, I might have put it higher, but that's okay. It's still it's a good noir story. Yeah. It's violent. There's no real, you know, we're not meant to feel empathy towards Madeline, nor are we meant to feel empathy for the frat boys. You know, it's just sort of all messy and dirty, right? And that's okay. That's the kind of stories these are.
All right, folks, we're going to take a short promo break, but we will be back with listener feedback from the previous episode. Stick around.
Hey there, comic fans and children of the 80s. My name is Steven, and I would like to invite you to join me on another G.I. Joe podcast. If you grew up yelling, "Yo, Joe," or flipping through dog-eared issues of G.I. Joe, a real American hero, this is the show for you. Each episode, we're tackling one issue of the classic Marvel comic series, starting all the way back in 1982. We'll break down the stories, the artwork, the characters, the wild twists, the covert missions, everything that made this series one of the most surprisingly rich comic runs of the decade. We'll follow the rise of Snake Eyes, the schemes of Cobra Commander, the battles, the vehicles, the ninjas, the chaos, and the totally over-the-top, totally awesome storytelling that defined 80s action. Whether you're reliving your childhood or discovering these comics for the first time, I'm here to guide you through it all with excitement, insight, and plenty of nostalgia. So grab your gear and join the team, because the mission begins now. Yo, Joe!
Science fiction, romance, swashbuckling adventure, all that and more is coming to DC Special Cast in 2026. I'm your host, Paul Ken. DC Special Cast is a podcast where each month a guest and I explore DC's special comics of the 1970s, like DC Special Series, DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, and others. This year, we'll have plenty of superhero action, including a special movie tie-in. But we also plan to cover Sergio Aragonés, The Star Hunters, Three Musketeers, and Love 1971.
But wait, there's more! Extra! Extra! Read all about it! I'm Sean M. Myers, and because Paul will not let me do a podcast about Newsies, we're going to do a special segment we are calling The Monthly Planet. I will join my Bat Brother Paul as we cover the 50th anniversary of the greatest series of DC House ads ever, The Daily Planet. Get ready to hear us talk about Direct Currents, Fred Hembeck, The Answer Man, and so much more.
So join us each month on DC Special Cast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Now that's special.
In our last episode, our last recording, we were talking about the dream of like the chain, the bugs or something like that, whatever that was. And I mistakenly referred to the Metamorphosis. I mistakenly credited it to Dostoevsky. And I meant Kafka, Franz Kafka. And a listener, Dick, corrected me on this. He said, "Your cockroach dad eats my flowers dream. Were you confusing Dostoevsky with Kafka? The latter wrote Metamorphosis and was a Czech, not a Russian. As far as I know, the closest Dostoevsky got to cockroaches is in his writing was letters complaining about living on cockroach soup while in prison, which is admittedly grounds for complaint." I did get good catch, Dick. I did mean Kafka, and I should have known that because there was a cartoon, an animated series called Home Movies, but that doesn't matter. But there was a joke about a rock opera of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis. It was all but like they just had songs about turning into a bug and everything. I just remembered like this whole thing is like, he is Franz Kafka. Franz Kafka.
I used to love that show. I don't remember that one. I'm going to have to look that up.
You have to find that one. I think one of the lines in that song, like, "Be careful if you get him pissed. He'll spite you with metaphor fists." Kafka. All right, next.
Chris Franklin wrote in to say, "Man, you guys weren't kidding about the brutal subject matter. I chose to listen to your show rather than read it. You don't have to be a parent to be incensed by such things, but it certainly makes it harder to stomach an all too real. I was lucky enough to never have any personal experiences like this, but I know others who have, and the damage, that, and as Ryan pointed out, the betrayal, never truly goes away. I see what you mean by the art getting more simplified as the issues progress. Gotta say, I still prefer this to Guy Davis, but maybe I'll feel different when I actually sit down to read the series. Or he may be like Tim Sale to me. I recognize the talent, but I just don't care for the style." Well, I I like Guy Davis. and I think you
I like Tim Sale too.
So. Yeah, right.
It's just, so the point where we disagree. But
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, and we should point out, I think people know, but you know, Chris Franklin is actually like a professional artist. He's mm-hmm. he does that for a living. Absolutely. He does that for fun. And he's wrong. I like Guy Davis. And I do understand how it is not for everybody. I can definitely see that, but I don't know if it just hit me at the right time or what that was about. But that art really speaks to me especially on this series. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really good match for this series, and it was a brutal storyline, mm-hmm. and I am not a parent myself, and it was difficult for me to read. I can only imagine what it's like for a mm-hmm. parent.
But Chris, Guy Davis draws boobies in this story arc, so give it a shot.
Maybe that'll bring Chris on board. next up, we had Comic Foyle, who said, I was so excited to see the new episode drop that I queued it right up. I've been excitedly waiting for your next installment, despite not having found time to reread issues 9 through 12, or even remind myself what they were about. Within seconds of listening, my heart was filled with dread. This storyline hurts my soul every time I read it. But I persevered, and I could admit that I thoroughly enjoyed everyone's analysis of the writing and art. You all seemed very much in sync with one another, but still brought a nice variety of individual insights to the table. Well, thank you, Comic Foyle. Your thoughts expressed on the culture of violence and the idea that everyone can be a brute gave me a lot of pause. I'm glad not to have read the story in advance now, and maybe this weekend I can read it with a new perspective and get some deeper appreciation for the craft and the creators put into making it. Keep up the great work. I'm a fan of what you are all doing. Thank you very much, Comic Foyle. It's very nice words.
Thank you very much, yeah. Rob McCarthy just said, oof, y'all read that for fun? I mean, fun and the podcast.
Yeah. So we have fun doing the podcasting, to put it that way.
Yeah.
Tim Price said, one perspective I keep thinking of is parenting and the perception of good versus bad parents. In the story, and actually throughout this series, the class divide is a recurring theme. It certainly is. There's mm-hmm. Riesling, who has all his wealth and also abuses and neglects his kids, but in relative private for appearance's sake. And Ramsey, who's down on his luck and giving all he can to raise his daughter right and desperate to make her healthy. So the family that has all the power and privilege they could want is admired, but his family is more dysfunctional than a boxer who's looked down on by the upper class and barely scraping by. And I find Ramsey a damn admirable father. And in spite of their compassion and good intentions, Wes and Diane have no, quote, skin in the game, as they aren't parents themselves. I'm not judging Wes and Diane, but I think that counterpoint is intentional on Wagner's part and shouldn't be forgotten. Maybe it will lead to more plot points later. I will admit, I hope little Emily is not gone from this series, since I want to see her heal from this horror, but I expect she is. I'm glad I read the story in one sitting. Back in the monthly days, it would have been brutal reading the end of part 3 and having to wait for a resolution. Thanks for the great episode, guys. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Tim. Next up, we had Dr. Ange, who said, I haven't read these comics in forever, so hearing you review them has been great. Sometimes I reread the books before I listen, sometimes after. This one I did after, but as you were discussing, panels entered my mind that must have been ingrained from when I last read it many years ago. Wesley saying his jaw after the boxers put on the cestas, and the girl saying she didn't like the new medicine, all came back to me. Signs of a shocking story if I could conjure that stuff up in my mind. Absolutely right, Dr. Ange. I can remember that Diane wanting to be intimate so closely to the time she was nearly raped seemed a little weird to me as well. No question.
And Brett Young from Fantastic Four podcast right here on the network said, I have to say the art is not my favorite. I feel this book definitely needs a gritty, ugly style of art considering the time period and essence of the stories. But while the overall storytelling is fine, the figures and movements often look wooden and unnatural.
Mm-hmm. No argument. Hopefully you like Guy Davis better, Brett.
Yeah. For the dream sequence, the last episode, our dream sequence discussion was just our weirdest dreams. So the listeners' responses to those.
Yeah, first up was Chris Franklin, who said, weirdest dream. I have two. One was very pivotal for me. As I have mentioned many times, I was traumatized by Lon Chaney Jr.'s transformation into the Wolfman in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein when I was 4. After that, I was terrified of werewolves for several years. I have nightmares about them often. When I was 6 or 7, I dreamt I was running near an old castle and a werewolf was chasing me. He was about to pounce on me when Batman swung in and kicked him. Batman then proceeded to pound the crap out of this werewolf while I cheered him on. No kidding, after that dream, I wasn't scared of werewolves. The Wolfman became my favorite Universal monster and monster movie. And I kind of like Batman more after that, too. That's a great story. I love that story. His second weird dream, I vividly remember from when I was in high school. Cindy and I were dating, and she lived out on this old country road way out in our country. Half the time when I drove home at night, I'd have trouble staying awake. I was in my bed dreaming about driving home from her house, almost falling asleep in my dream. When I came to, two figures, a man and a woman, were standing on each side of the road ahead of me. Their skin was blue-gray like a Romero zombie. As I passed by, they reached into the car, and the woman grabbed me and pulled me out of the car while I was still moving. I immediately woke up, but I can still see her rotting face. I like the first one better.
Comic Foil said, as for crazy dreams, I also rarely retain any memory of them after waking, except for two. One was a pretty exciting sci-fi adventure where I got to ride around on a levitating trash can lid while alien dragons soared through the sky, shooting lasers from their eyes. Everybody's having more interesting dreams than me. In the second, I was walking home from middle school with a friend and figured out I could fly through sheer force of concentration. But I was 12 at the time and could barely get 10 feet off the ground without almost falling, because what 12-year-old could concentrate that intensely for more than a few seconds? Suffice to say, it was a very frustrating dream.
Tim Price wrote in to say, oh, right, weird dreams. I may mention that I'm a basket case when directing a show at the theater, and also the rest of the year. Don't know why I mentioned that. I'm terrible at remembering details of my dreams, and so I don't have any to any great degree. But for snippets, there was an awful nightmare as a kid where basically the sun was destroying the earth and I was in a ship with my family, so that was not fun. I've also had dreams where I've met characters from TV or comics, like in high school where I met the New Mutants because we were all the same age, but they looked like real people, not drawings. I had the strongest memory that Rain, Wolfsbane, was adorable. It's our second werewolf. And there was me dreaming that I was watching new episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation after its final episode had come out.
And then he continued on and said, but hey, remember what I said about directing theater? Well, in years past, I would have that anxiety dream of showing up as an actor and not knowing any lines or songs and can't find my costume. Well, last year I had that dream again, but now as a director. So I showed up and none of the cast knew their lines. The sound and lighting don't know their cues, and 20 kids running around messing with the costumes. To which I say, thank you, my subconscious, for making that dream better. Thanks, Tim.
Dr. Grange said, I have very vivid dreams, so there are too many. But I think ER providers, both docs and nurses, have workmares where they are in scary medical situations. One I had that stuck with me was that I walked in by a room where a patient looked very ill and checked to see who was seeing the patient on the tracking board, only to see that there was no patient listed in that room. Meaning, someone put a sick person in an exam room that no clinician knew about and therefore didn't see and care for. When I went back in to check on the patient, I discovered they had passed, and I kept saying, who put this patient in the room? When did they do it? I woke up panicked with my heart rate through the roof. As far as weird dreams, when I was bartending at a busy bar in D.C., I would often get home at 3 a.m. and crash out. Almost every night, I'd have what some refer to as frustration dreams. I'd dream I was bartending and kept trying to make some drink. It would always be something different. But something kept getting in the way of the space, or the space would grow around me, or something else would distract me, or I couldn't find an ingredient, or everything would spin upside down. I could never actually make the drink. I used to have this dream almost nightly for years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you for sharing those, guys. Those were a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks. Those were great. So now we're going to do a dream sequence. This time, the dream sequence question is, who is your favorite fictional hero, TV, comics, movies, whatever, who wears a hat? So let's start with you, Max.
Oh, boy. Well, this was actually a much harder question than I expected it to be. So I went through the usual. You know, of course, there's Indiana Jones is probably the most famous. I thought about Zorro, who was a favorite of mine since I was a kid. But I actually landed on a very old favorite. One of my first favorite characters ever, actually, Sherlock Holmes.
Deerstalker hat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that is as famous for him as his pipe. And, you know, it's part of his profile whenever you see him, you know, drawn or characterized somewhere. And yeah, I mean, Sherlock Holmes for me was one of the first, he might have actually been the first detective story that I read, you know, something with Sherlock Holmes in it. His ideas of observation and looking for the simplest explanation for a crime, or, you know, the clues and all that sort of thing, really stuck with me for a very long time. And I still kind of approach problems that way. And it's Sherlock Holmes all the way for me.
Cool. How about you, Ryan?
I think I almost limited myself in my thinking to sort of the fedora or the hat.
Oh, interesting. Because I thought you were going the top hat route. Go ahead.
No. So I definitely would have, had I been thinking about that, I might have gone with Zatanna Peaky Blinders thing with all like different types of hats and everything like that. But I was thinking of Zorro a little bit. I thought of Dick Tracy. The Shadow is really close to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, It really, honestly, probably would be the Sandman that we've been talking about. I'm thinking of somebody else, but the Shadow, just because of that whole look and that mystique, is just so cool and visceral with the pulp. But it's really, it's not that much of a competition. It is Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just
my fondness for those movies. And it was all just from my childhood. Yeah. So.
Well, I mean, who is Indiana Jones without his hat? That's exactly. Such an iconic part of his character.
He goes back for it all the time.
He does. As for me, when I first thought of comics characters, so people came up, you know, I thought the Shadow more of a pulp character, you know, got Jonah Hex, not really. I thought Jay Garrick, but now he's got a helmet, not a hat. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that maybe count. I thought of Zatanna. I saw it for sure. I didn't want to pick Zatanna because I figured for sure you'd pick Zatanna, Ryan.
Yeah, sure.
Then I thought, when I broadened my thinking, I actually had to, I Googled like characters, fictional characters with hats, just to get like a long list of them. And there's tons, right? And I'm like, oh, of course, you know, yeah, it's Indiana Jones, a Lone Ranger. I thought you might be interested in Max. I don't know if you like him. Then there's some off the board ones. You know, there's Woody and Jesse from Toy Story. Mm-hmm. Great characters.
Yeah, sure.
Wear hats. Not a great, like, literary character, but one that I have a soft spot because my boys watched the Pokemon cartoon constantly when they were little. The Ash character, always wearing his little red cap.
Yeah.
But. I did go with something that's a family favorite. I went with Perry the Platypus from Phineas and Ferb.
Nice. Nice.
He takes the hat off. He's a regular platypus. Puts the hat on. He becomes Secret Agent Perry the Platypus. So
I've got a painting of Perry the Platypus in my son's room.
I love Perry the Platypus. I love me some Perry. So that's where I'm going.
Nice one.
The listeners, we want to hear what you think. So when you write in your comments, tell us your favorite character who wears a hat.
All right, folks, we will be back at some point in 2026. Hopefully you won't have to wait too long to talk about the fifth story arc, The Scorpion. And things take a turn in the Sandman-Diane relationship, but wait for that.
And, of course, thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please support us by subscribing to Justice Society Presents on your preferred podcast app. You can also help us promote the show on social media by liking and reposting.
And of course, like we said, please leave comments on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, under JSA Presents.
Finally, please consider supporting the network on Patreon at patreon.com/FWpodcasts.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next time, pleasant dreams.
I could say Bella, Bella, even seven bar, each language only helps me tell you how grand you are. You will understand.
I gotta Google something really quick. Feel free to vamp for time.